everyone. Everybody good? Good. Me too. I say me too, but really so much of the time it's poor me, poor thing, problems, afraid, needy, pathetic, worthless, lonely. All these scary things out there, all these needs and wants, afraid that something bad's going to happen to me, what the future holds. I think we're all afraid of dying. They realize it or not, on a very deep level. And sometimes I think we're more afraid of living. Truly more afraid of living. What might happen? Better not to. Better not even to try. Just keep the light hidden. Safer. We all have a poor me. And at different times in my life, poor me has manifested as a aggressive bulldozer plowing away everything that stood in its path. And at other times, poor me manifested as being so depressed, could hardly get out of bed. Imagine you all have your own particular flavors of poor me. We're all of us, more or less, caught on this merry-go-round, a desire and dissatisfaction of poor me. We all of us have certain conditions that we think are necessary for our happiness. Very often, it's one thing, one primary desire at a time. Of course, it shifts, but any one time, it's one primary desire that seems to us to be the central component that's missing to make us happy. Well, if only I had a girlfriend, if only my husband was a better lover, if only I could live at a monk at Great Vow Zen Monastery and practice the Dharma all the time, then I'd be happy. Don't think about it. So Dogen Zenji said that the first two awakenings of great beings, the first was having few desires, and the second is knowing how much is enough. And how much is enough is it's a tricky thing. It's an interesting thing. If you're a farmer, it can be, if only I had enough land. There was a farmer once in Russia who had that if only. He was a mujik, lived as a peasant on the steppes and worked as a sharecropper, working on somebody else's land. And he had enough to eat. His family had enough to eat, but the work was rough. He complained a lot to himself about it, but the truth of the matter is he found it kind of fulfilling in a way. He liked working the land. He liked being out of doors. But whenever his wife's sister would come from the city, they'd start talking, and there'd always be this comparison that would happen. And he would inevitably hear this and feel himself lacking, and he'd think, oh, if only I had enough land. If only I had enough land, then everything would be fine. So finally one day, the widow lady who lived on a little ways away decided she was going to sell her property. And he said, you know, I'm going to get that property. So he went out and he approached her and they cut a deal. They had to put his son to work, take an advance on his son's wages. They had to endure great privation and hardship to be able to get this land, but sure enough, they got it, and in time, they paid off the debt, and they worked hard. But pretty soon, with this additional land, came problems with the neighbors. They'd have their cows would encroach on his land, and there'd be problems with him cutting his trees, and pretty soon, he was taking them to court, involving lawyers, God forbid. And he wasn't so happy with this land. So he finally said, you know what, the problem is, the problem is I don't have enough land. If I had enough land, then it wouldn't matter so much what happened at the periphery of it. I need more land. And it just so happened that a trader was passing by, and he told them about this unexplored region. It might be like Canada or something. This unexplored region that, you know, there was all this land to be had. There were these Aboriginal people that lived on it. They were only too happy to share their land. So he kind of set off by boat and walked a long distance and finally arrived at this place. He had a hat full of money because he knew it was going to cost something. And he got there, and sure enough, these were wonderful people. He sat down with them and talked and said, "Oh, yeah, we're happy to give you just as much land as you want, you know." And he gave them presents, and they thought he was a fine fellow, and he thought they were fine fellows. And they said, "There's only one thing." He said, "Well, how much is it going to cost?" And they said, $1,000. It's always $1,000. $1,000 a day. And he said, $1,000 a day? He said, "Yep." Chief said, "You can have as much land as you can walk around in one day for $1,000. But the deal is, if you can't walk around it, if you don't come back to the starting place, you lose $1,000. So he thought this was a fine deal. And they cut their deal, and the next morning he set out at sunrise, a great fanfare. His money sitting glinting in the sun on top of this hillock where all the native folks were watching him. And he walked and he walked and he walked. And he said, "Surely I can walk 35 miles in a day." And he set out, and it got hotter, and he was walking, and he was just driving himself. And every time he'd reach a corner, he'd dig a hole with a spade to mark where the corner of the property was. But he overreached himself, and he got to a place where he only had 4 hours left, and he had more distance than he could possibly cover in 4 hours. And even though he was worried about the boundaries of his farm being a little irregular, he just set off at a great rate of speed coming back, just driving himself like a horse, excited about this great property he was going to get. But as he got closer and closer to the hillock where the money was, he realized he didn't think he was going to make it. So he drove himself harder and harder and harder. His heart was just hammering in his chest. And he got to the hillock. As he was getting to the hillock, he thought the sun was going down. He wasn't going to make it. But he heard the people calling and clamoring on the hillock, and he realized from up above where they were, they could still see the sun. So he got to the hillock, and he ran up. He ran up with his life, just as hard as he could. And he got up at the top, and he had a great heart attack and died. So how much land is enough? For him, about 6 feet. That's how much it took to bury him. So how much is enough? 6 feet, maybe. The inevitability of death, and no one knows when. And yet we persist in trying to store up treasure, trying to fend off the tiger of impermanence and uncertainty. What can this treasure profit us in the face of impermanence and death? The world is a wonder and an amazement, my friends. It's a wonder and amazement calling to us to engage it moment by moment. Come play with me, Hoban. Come play with me. It's a wonder and amazement, but you can't lean on it too heavily. You can't own it. You can't store it up like treasure. And ultimately, there isn't any safe refuge in it. There's nothing that can protect you against your own self-nature of impermanence and emptiness. So ask yourself, what's your if only? Maybe it isn't enough land. Maybe it isn't something you think you need. Maybe it's something you're afraid of losing that you see as necessary for your happiness, material things, your health, respect. We all have these needs that we see as necessary, things that have to be taken care of. I've said before, I had a law partner at one time who had this great saying. He said, "Needs expand in proportion to available income." You know, what seemed like a luxury, you know, as your income expands, it becomes a need. You know, how could I do with less? You know? Simplify, 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 Thoreau said. One day, the Buddha and a group of his monks had finished eating lunch together, and a farmer, very agitated, came by and he asked him, he says, monks, have you seen my cows? I don't think I can survive so much misfortune. And the Buddha says, well, what happened? And the man said, well, this morning, all 12 of my cows ran away, and my whole crop of sesame plants was eaten by insects. And the Buddha said, we haven't seen your cows. Maybe they've gone the other direction. So the farmer went off in that direction in a great tizzy, and the Buddha turned to his monks and he says, dear friends, truly we're the happiest people on earth. We don't have any cows. We don't have any sesame plants to lose. But we, all of us, try to accumulate more and more. And we think these cows are essential. They're needs that we have to have for our existence. And in fact, as I'm sure you've all seen, one degree or another, too often these needs are the very obstacles that prevent us from being happy. Release your cows. Release your cows. Release your cows as a path to freedom. Release your cows and see for yourself the truth of the Dharma. The truth of the Dharma that doesn't change. We can all be truly happy. A monk was walking down a dusty road barefoot when he stepped on something sharp. It stuck in his heel, and after a few steps, he stopped to pull it out. And lo and behold, it was an incredibly valuable gemstone that's just laying in the dust. So he rinsed it off, tossed it in his satchel along with a partially eaten loaf of bread that he had that he was going to eat for his meal that day. And a little farther down the road, he came upon a beggar. And the beggar saw the half-eaten loaf of bread sticking out of his bag, and he leaped in front of the monk and he bowed three times. He said, oh, venerable sir, I'm a poor starving beggar. Can I just have a taste of your bread? And the monk pulled the loaf out of his satchel, and before handing it to the beggar, he pulled the gem out of the crust where it had gotten embedded, sitting in his satchel. He handed the entire loaf to the beggar, but the beggar had seen the gemstone. And he pleaded, oh, worthy one, I've taken your only meal of the day, and that's not right. He said, I see you had a gemstone which would relieve me completely of my situation. I'd be wealthy. You're a monk. You have no need of such things. Can I give you back your bread in exchange for the gem? And at this, the monk promptly gave the gemstone to the beggar, telling him also to keep the bread. The beggar was ecstatic, and he galloped off down the road, waving his hands in the air. The monk, noticing it was time for zazen, sat down under a tree, and after a few moments, he became aware of somebody standing beside him, and opening his eyes, he saw the beggar, who thrust out his hands with the gem and said, venerable sir, can I please return the gem to you? I don't want it. The monk said, well, what, sir, do you want? And the beggar replied, I want what you have that allowed you to give away everything. Truth of the Dharma that doesn't change. Have to be careful, though, that we don't turn this into, don't turn our Dharma practice into a hunting, questing mind. Lusting after this, I want what you have that allowed you to give everything away. It's so easy to fall into the trap of seeing our Buddha nature as something to be watered and cultivated, a seed that'll in time grow into its own magnificence. I'll grow into a mighty Dharma warrior, a fearless one, a bodhisattva. But it's not a seed. It's not a matter of developing your own magnificence or growing into your own magnificence. It's truly a matter of realizing your own magnificence just exactly as you are. Living your life from that ground, being fully and completely what you are, and living fully and completely this moment of your life that you've been given to live. Each one of us, all alone in the universe, each one of us truly a separate and complete universe. So realize your own magnificence, my friends. Realize your complete responsibility for what happens in this universe. Realize your complete freedom. It's an old saying that it's best to ride a horse in the direction it's going. I often remind myself of that, sometimes more successfully than others. It's like practicing with the precepts. It's not a matter of moving from bad boy to good boy. Oh, I'm going to become a good boy. Yeah, I'll be a good boy. Then Jogen will tell me I'm a good boy and put a little dab of royal jelly behind my ear and I get to wear the tricolored cockade in my cap, you know. What it is a matter of, though, is not following the path of tooth and claw, letting go of the merry-go-round of desire. It's truly a practice of according with what is. It's truly a matter of giving life to the truth of life just as it is. According with the Dharma. How can we act in accord with the Dharma right now? What is it right here? Right now. Pay attention. Right now to listening to Hoban. Maybe to the pain of listening to Hoban. Maybe moment by moment, other moments, to the joy, to the hunger, to the beauty. What needs to be taken care of right now? Moment by moment, don't get caught on any moment. Don't drag the past or lean into the future. Don't get hung up on anything. Neither lusting after it or pushing it away. Giving yourself up to it moment by moment so that we truly forget ourselves in engaging in this moment, in this moment. We encounter situations, we encounter people, but we don't get caught on any detail. It's not circumstances that determine our happiness. Easy to say until things go sideways. But even when things go sideways, when you take up the path of practice, there's this awareness in the background that these manacles that bind us in unhappiness and dissatisfaction are really forged in our minds. We and Blake call them mind-forged manacles. There's no circumstances in and of themselves that determine our happiness, certainly not wealth. I've known, practicing law, many, many wealthy men, most of them pretty unsatisfied. It's not a matter of more land. It's not a question of having friends. He used to be so nice, now he's a jerk. I can't believe he said that to me. It isn't a matter of good health. We take it for granted. It isn't the circumstances, it's our thinking about the circumstances. Life, anybody's life, inevitably includes sunny days and stormy days. It inevitably includes pain, and it inevitably includes loss. I don't care who you are. I don't care how realized you are. It's a reality of sucking air. It's a reality of being a human being. So often, people come to practice when they're suffering. I've seen it so many times, and they take up the path of practice, and they realize some of the fruits of practice. And then their circumstances turn. Times get good. New relationship, maybe. Everything seems easy and fortunate. Seems like it'll last forever. yeah, I got this mindfulness stuff down. I'm really kind of enlightened. I just didn't realize it. Yeah, I get that. Yeah. Seems like their lives are blessed and you'll never have to face adversity again. Everything's just fine. But sooner or later, karma inevitably turns. Hardship and pain arises. Sometimes people think, I think, I shouldn't have to face pain. I just shouldn't have to. It's not right. It's not how it should be. I should be happy. It should be that things are easy and fortunate. But the reality is the goddesses of good and bad fortune always travel as a pair. And sooner or later, we all have to face the pain that life inevitably dishes out. When we live with gratitude, when we live with appreciation, when we live with attention and presence, we take life as it comes. We take life as it comes and we ride the horse of life in the direction it's going. You can say, well, how could it be otherwise? And that's true. But man, oh man, do we ever try, eh? Do we ever try? So when we live with appreciation, we take a bigger view of things. We see the big picture. We look at the big picture. We may not always see it, but we look at the big picture instead of just my narrow little personal wants and dislikes. We accept, we practice that sometimes you have to turn on a dime when life requires you to turn on a dime. Because I can promise you this much, life ain't never going to match the script you write for it. What a way to live your life, though. What a way to live your life, to accept each moment for what it is, without testing it against your expectations, without judging it good or bad. I've truly, in my own practice right now, I don't know what's good and what's bad anymore. What seems one moment you think, oh, this is going to be good, you just realize it just one thing flows into another. One thing just flows into another. Realize that what seems good is just how I want it to be for myself and my world right now. It matches my picture of things. Looking back on my life, I got a lot more wrinkles than a lot of you, less than some of you, though. Looking back on my life, I've had times of great ease and great joy. And I've had times of incredible pain and hardship. I've had times of wealth. I've had times of incredible grinding poverty. One flowing into the other. Each circumstance of hardship and pain having just to be the way it is. Pain flowing into ease, ease flowing into pain. World isn't here to match our expectations, how we think things should be. The rain spoils our picnic. Who are we to say it shouldn't rain? If we can step out of our petty concerns and accept conditions as they are, life experience can be beautiful. There's a story in one of D.T. Suzuki's books about a man who was traveling across a field and he encountered a tiger. And he fled. The tiger was after him, close after him, and coming to a cliff, to a precipice, he caught hold of a root of a wild vine and he swung himself down over the edge. And he got down far enough that the tiger was sniffing at him from above. And trembling, he looked down to where down at the bottom of the cliff, there was another tiger waiting to eat him. Only the vine held him. But then the vine started to give way, and he saw there were two mice, little by little, starting to gnaw away at the vine. And just then, he saw an incredibly luscious strawberry nearby. And grasping the vine with one hand, he plucked the strawberry with the other. How sweet! is another version of this story where the strawberry turns out to be poisonous. Buddha said, be like the earth, Rahula. Talking to his son, Rahula, he said, you pour perfumed water on the earth, you pour urine on the earth, the earth accepts them both without complaint. Complete equanimity. Accepting and engaging fully whatever life presents us. These manacles that bind us are all forged in the mind. There was an old woman who was always crying. And this monk always saw her crying, no matter what was happening. And one day he asked her, and she said, well, my older daughter is married to an umbrella merchant, and my younger daughter is married to a man who sells noodles. And whenever the weather was nice and sunny, she'd cry and think, oh my God, this is so horrible. The weather's so nice and sunny, my daughter's umbrella shop's going to fail. What am I going to do? And when the weather was bad and it was raining, she'd cry again for her younger daughter. Oh my goodness, if the noodles don't dry in the sun, the younger daughter won't be able to sell. What's she going to do? So she cried and cried no matter what the weather was. So one day she told her woes to this monk. And he smiled and he said, you just got to change the way you're thinking about it. When the sun is shining, don't think about the umbrellas. Think about the noodles. And when it's raining, think about the umbrellas. Sage advice, eh? As a kid, it used to drive me crazy when it would rain on a picnic or some outing, and the adults would say, well, it's good for the farmers. Well, it's like all folk wisdom. Taking a big perspective, seeing all of the circumstances of this present moment, not forging these manacles in our mind to bind us. When you appreciate your life, when you know and embrace the experience of being alive, it's a choice to experience this moment. It's a choice to embrace this moment of your life. And it truly becomes a life of gratitude. This little piece is from Hogen Roshi's first Dharma teacher, Philip Kaplow. It's a piece he wrote for Thanksgiving. He says, today, as you all know, is Thanksgiving. Of all our national holidays, none is more in accord with the spirit of Buddhism than this one. In our daily prostrations before the Buddha, and placing our hands palm to palm in gassho when greeting each other, and many other ways we're expressing our thanks and gratitude for a multitude of things, but mostly for our human body and the opportunity it affords to come to self-realization. And while the holidays were originally an expression of thanks of the Plymouth colony for the first rich harvest after a winter of privation and starvation, it really symbolizes the spirit of gratitude that resides in the heart of all of us. Of all emotions, the feeling of gratitude is probably the most dignified. It lies at the core of a spiritual life. Even dogs and cats show it. Not to feel and express this most elevated of emotions, therefore, is to be lower than an animal. Until one has begun to feel real gratitude to parents, to teachers, to family, to children and friends, to members of the Sangha, to all who have made it possible for us to know and realize ourselves, to realize the Dharma, one's practice is woefully deficient. Gratitude is really the language of the heart. And yet, when we look on the world with eyes dimmed with ignorance, hearts clouded with despair, we're bound to ask ourselves, what is there to be grateful for? Are we to be grateful for global starvation? For an environment that's terribly polluted? For the fact that 1 of 5 Americans will die painfully of cancer? For the violence in our own country and elsewhere? Nevertheless, as Buddhists, we see a great deal for which we can be grateful. First, we can be grateful to our parents for having provided us with a human life that enables us to awaken to the most fundamental experience any living being can have. Not long ago, I read an article that held that a man's most fundamental life experience is to be a soldier, a woman's to have a child. But for the truth seeker, the most fundamental life experience possible is to wake up to the real nature of life, ours and everyone's. Those who are married can certainly be grateful to each other. Wives can be grateful to their husbands for enabling them to know all the emotions of a wife, and vice versa. Parents can be grateful to their children, without whom they would never know the joys and sorrows of parenthood. And really, we need to be at least just as grateful for the difficulties as for the enjoyment and the pleasure, for it's through our sufferings we have the chance to grow and enrich our lives. How can we not be grateful to the Sangha for its communal warmth and mutual aid, for the friendships based on honesty and love? Without working together as a community, a Sangha, how could we come to know the secret joy that opens to us through meaningful ceremonies? Is there anything more frustrating than to feel deep emotion and not be able to express it? This is why ceremonies and rituals, when they have genuine feeling behind them, are so vital and meaningful. And of course, we can be grateful to all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, visible and invisible, who make it possible for us to hear the truth, to believe it, and to experience it in our lives. We hear it said in Buddhism that really there is no one to feel grateful to and no one to express it to. In the most profound sense, that is, of course, true. As we progress deeper into practice, so much of what we formerly took to be real vanishes before our touch and sight. Our cherished delusions and deluded notions of right and wrong cannot stand up to the light of the truth within us. Those whose minds are still clouded by fear and anxiety at a certain point in their training, when their old unreal world is slipping away and the new one has not yet entirely emerged, can find their fears increasing instead of diminishing. But this is only the halfway point. I hope you know that as you persevere, you will achieve a rock-like steadiness, a joyous transparency, and an all-pervading freedom. It's also said that in bowing down before Buddhas, there's actually nobody to bow down to and no one bowing. Who bows to what? In truth, nobody bows to anyone. And yet there's this wonderful, free, gratitude-filled bowing down. In this subjectless, objectless, wholehearted bowing, nothing is excluded. The whole world bows. All creatures, men, women, animals, insects, bow to one another in mutual greeting. Is this not true thanksgiving? A less strenuous way to express thanks is to put the hands together, palm to palm, in what's called gassho. Do it often enough and you find the rigid outlines of a self-absorbed ego softening. Feelings of humility, respect, and gratitude emerge. In this lowering of the mast of ego, it's impossible to have an egotistical thought or to speak an unkind word. Thanksgiving is a deep sentiment, and for Buddhists, is not celebrated one day a year. For the spiritual-minded person, it's a way of life, embracing every day, every hour, every minute, a way of living that's truly life-affirming, filled with thanks for everything. So beautiful. Some of you may have read Thomas Merton, this Trappist monk who really, I think, defined spirituality in North America for my parents' generation. And he once wrote, and please don't get hung up on the Christian language. You can substitute the universe for God if you wish. But he wrote, "To be grateful is to recognize the love of God in everything given us. Because everything is given us. Every breath we draw is a gift of love. Every moment of existence is a grace. Gratitude, therefore, takes nothing for granted, is never unresponsive, is constantly awakening to new wonder and to the praise of the goodness of God. For the grateful person knows that the universe is good, not by hearsay, but by experience. And that is what makes all the difference. We live in constant dependence upon this merciful kindness, and thus our whole life is a life of gratitude, a constant response to this help which comes to us at every moment. Our whole life is a gift, my friends. It's truly a matter of grace. But if we forge manacles of comparison in our mind, this world of wonder and amazement becomes gray and painful. Oh, this weather isn't as good as it was yesterday. He's bothering me. I'm worthless. I'm failing. I'm winning. This is good. That's bad. It's better. How do we cultivate? How do we cultivate a spirit of gratitude? Certainly by practicing Zazen, of course. But it's truly a practice. You have to practice gratitude. You have to turn your attention to the beauty and grace that's already present in your daily life. The Dharma, the truth of the Dharma, is always present, but you have to turn towards it. You have to practice it. Like priest Pao Che of Makoshan, we have to fan ourselves with a fan of practice. Whatever we pay attention to expands. How to cultivate this spirit of gratitude? Pay attention to the acts of kindness and compassion. See that the whole of each moment of our lives simply arises, just arises as a gift. Just pay attention to it. Come play with me. Turning away from the thoughts of criticism and judgment. Kind of like it sometimes. There's a righteous feeling of being angry, judgmental. Turning away from our complaining mind. Keeping alive your sense of wonder and amazement. The mystery. Where does this come from? Where does it go? Recalling what we owe others. Our meal chant that we chant, the reflections chant that we chant before we eat, it used to go, the way it used to be written, it used to say, 52 labors brought us this food and we should know how it comes to us. Turning your mind to your mother and your father, our teachers. Cultivating the spirit of gratitude by practicing kindness. Kind eyes and gentle hands. Practicing humility, practicing attention, and practicing presence and appreciation. A couple of centuries ago, there was a woman Zen master named Sono, and people would come to her from all over and tell her the challenges they were facing in their lives. Probably Hogan's had his share of that. Health problems, money problems, problems with relationships. And her advice was always the same. Whatever problem she'd be presented with, whatever she was asked, her advice was always that whatever happens, just say, thank you for everything. I have no complaint whatsoever. Thank you for everything. I have no complaint whatsoever. So one day, a Buddhist man came to her and asked, what can I do to put my heart at rest? And she said, every morning and every evening, whenever anything happens to me, whenever anything happens to you, keep on saying, thank you for everything. I have no complaint whatsoever. So the man did this for a year, but his heart was not at peace. So he told Sono his life had not changed and that he was the same selfish person as he was before. And she immediately said, thank you for everything. I have no complaint whatsoever. And on hearing these words, the man experienced a great joy and returned home with no complaints. Probably for a little while. Yeah. But what an amazing practice to choose to live your life from a place of gratitude. An appreciation for whatever life is presenting, to choose life, to say yes, yes, to whatever moment life is presenting, however painful and challenging it might be, to welcome it on its own terms. And to do that, we have to take Roshi's advice and stop making up stories about how it should be, about right and wrong and gain and loss and how I want it to be. Uchiyama Roshi says, open the hand of thought. Open the hand of thought and engage things as they are. Cast off the mind-forged manacles. Engage life on its own terms. This moment, this moment, this moment. Christian mystic Meister Eckhart, who was an incredibly wise man, once said, if the only prayer you ever said was thank you, that would be enough. If the only prayer you ever said was thank you, that would be enough. And Epictetus said, it's a wise man who doesn't grieve for what he doesn't have and who rejoices for what he does have. So, pretty damn easy for me to say, sitting up here. Easy to say when things are going well. But how to accord with the Dharma when things are challenging? Times of ill health, times of death and heartbreak. Thank you very much. I have no complaints whatsoever. Truly, as I said, we have to practice with it. There's a quality of thankfulness in the challenges that life presents us with. There's a recognition of our responsibility for the choice and habits of mind that we've cultivated that lead to our suffering. And there's a recognition that we have a choice in terms of the direction that our lives take us. Without the challenges and adversities, how do you cultivate? How do you practice patience and endurance and resilience? So my own practice, I'm a little bit grateful for the little challenges. You practice in these times of the little challenges. And in truth, there is a quality of cultivation of patience and endurance. There is no demon more ferocious than your thinking mind, and there's nothing that is as eminently trainable if you choose to do it. But you got to put yourself into the cooker. You got to be prepared to say, thank you very much. I have no complaints whatsoever. Sometimes, too, what seem like horrible experiences, these challenges can propel people into deep insight and experiences of awakening, experiences of death or near death of a loved one, of yourself, or of loss or of divorce. The membrane that we think defines us becomes very thin. See through what seems so solid, and to realize the underlying dreamlike nature of things, to see that none of these horrible experiences have any independent existence apart from the mind, and that all just arises and passes away against the backdrop of the mind of still awareness. In truth, these horrible, challenging experiences can be a catalyst for realizing this mind of still awareness, a catalyst for realizing your essential nature, for realizing the Dharma that's always true, a catalyst for seeing through suffering. To or Zenji's Bodhisattva vow that we chant sometimes, there's a remarkable passage. He says, how much more should we be kind and merciful towards human beings, even those who are foolish? Though they become our sworn enemies, reviling and persecuting us, we should regard them as bodhisattva manifestations who, in their great compassion, are employing skillful means to help emancipate us from the twisted karma we've produced over countless kalpas through our biased, self-centered views. So we practice gratitude. And true gratitude cannot but help to lead to the practice of generosity. Because generosity is the function of gratitude. Generosity is the function of attention and presence and appreciation. This moment, and everything that you say mine to, all of the treasure that you've stored up, all of your health, everything that you say mine to comes into your hands to give it away. Comes into your hands to do something with it. I'm going to keep it all here. I'm going to keep it like a dragon storing it all up. So what are you going to do with it? You eat rice and you go sit on the couch, it's rice to sit on the couch. If you eat rice to sit zazen, then it's rice to sit zazen. If we try to hold on to it, if we're like dragons sitting on our hoards of gold, oh, I've got $1 million in the bank, I'm doing pretty well, I should be okay. If we try to hold on to it, it just sours. Become afraid and worried. So giving is the first of the bodhisattva paramitas. Giving is the antidote to selfishness. It's a dharma gate to deep joy. There's a story about the Zen poet Ikkyu, who one time was returning from a party, and the host had given him a bunch of food, wrapped up, probably some sushi and stuff, wrapped up in a bento box, and he was heading back to his place and feeling pretty good about life. And there was a beggar who asked him, please, sir, please, can you share something with me? And so Ikkyu was feeling so good about this, he took this whole bento box and he just gave it to the beggar, and the beggar took it, and Ikkyu waited, and he looked at him, and he kept waiting, and he said, well, he said, aren't you even going to say thank you? And the beggar said, thank you, but surely you got something more out of this exchange than that. The teaching, the Mahayana teaching, is that the first stage on the path of the Bodhisattva, it's the joyous stage. It's a path. It's a stage of being filled with joy. It's a practice of being joyful. And what is that joy? It's the joy in giving. It's the joy in giving. It's said that at the time of the Buddha, foremost in his lay disciples, foremost in the practice of giving, was a man called Anathapindika, called Siddhartha. You can see his, in Magadha, you can go and stood outside where his house was supposed to have been. It's kind of a ring of rocks now, but the Buddha used him as an example a number of times, his generosity as being the fundamental step on the path to freedom, to fearlessness. It's not the only step or the final step. But if you can't practice generosity, man, are you caught. Man, are you clinging. Clinging to what? To me, my needs, my fears, my despair about what my future may bring. Protecting myself. Foundation of practice is giving, giving joyfully. It's so incredibly moving and beautiful. Any of you who've been in Southeast Asia, where you go and in the morning the monks come out and people are coming out into the streets to give to the monks. Just this great joy in giving to the monks. So we kind of practice generosity. But we kind of hedge our bets too, right? I vow to wake up completely in this lifetime and realize my true nature. Then I added later, for the sake of all beings. I vow to realize the fundamental impermanent nature of life and the emptiness of all things. But we hedge our bets. We vow to realize these truths, but in the meantime, I'm still going to kind of follow my path of desire. I'll give a little bit. I'm going to kind of follow the path of tooth and claw, because I'd still like to get what I want and hold on to what I have. I just kind of want to be enlightened at the same time. There's a saying in law that you can't approbate and reprobate at the same time. As a tax lawyer, we used to say it a little more simply. We'd say you can't suck and blow at the same time. That's a deep truth. In the old city of Jerusalem, I'm told, there's a particularly narrow, torturous gate through the old walls of the city that was called the Eye of the Needle. In the Christian Bible, it said that Christ said it's easier for a heavily loaded camel to pass through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to realize the peace of nirvana. Anathapindika, this wealthy lay disciple of the Buddha, he was so moved when he first met the Buddha. He lived in a city called Srivasti, which is walking distance, probably 5 days from where he met the Buddha, and he was visiting his family members at the time and on business, and he met the Buddha, and he was so moved that he asked the Buddha if he would come to Srivasti, and the Buddha said, well, he asked him if he'd come, he said, I'll build a monastery. And the Buddha said, yes, if you build a monastery, I'll come. So he went back to Srivasti, and he looked around, and where am I going to build this? And he found this, the perfect piece of land, but it was owned by Prince Jetta. It was this beautiful pleasure park in Srivasti. So he went to the prince, and he said, can I buy this? I want to buy it for a monastery for this incredible spiritual teacher. It'll benefit the whole of the city. And the prince says, no, it's not for sale. I keep my deer and my peacocks and my elephants there, and you know, I'm not interested in selling it. And the guy said, I'll pay anything for it. So the prince said, I'll tell you what. He said, if you cover every inch of the ground of this park with gold coins, I'll give it to you. And Anathapindika said, done. And the cart started to, so the story goes, the cart started to roll in, cart after cart after cart, and the prince couldn't believe it. And finally, there was just one corner of the park left, and the prince said, look, he said, you know what? I'm going to donate this last corner of the park just so I get the I get that much of the merit that goes along with it. It's also, I read when I was on pilgrimage in India that it was also at different of the pilgrimage locations in India, there's banyan trees planted that are said to be grafts, roots from the original Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya that the Buddha sat under when he realized himself. And it said that it was Anathapindika that planted these because the monks would be sad when the Buddha was away. And the Buddha had said, well, plant a Bodh tree, a banyan tree, and then they can sit under it and they'll be a place for them to practice and reflect on their practice. So Anathapindika was fabulously wealthy, but he also had challenges in his life with his business, with his son and his daughter, and he ultimately ended up bankrupt. And he went to the Buddha. He said, I've got nothing left to give. And the Buddha said, give your presence, give your attention, practice. Everybody has such busy lives these days. Jobs are busy and stressful and challenging. Although he was also busy with his life, Anathapindika always found time to practice with the community and study the Dharma. The Buddha once gave a talk to Anathapindika. He said, generosity is a step on the path to freedom, but far more meritorious is to practice loving kindness. And more meritorious meritorious yet is to take refuge in the three treasures, in the Buddha mind, in the Dharma, in the Sangha, to accord with the Dharma, to practice with the Sangha. And more meritorious yet is to take up the practice of the precepts. And fundamentally more meritorious yet is to see into the truth of impermanence and emptiness. So the Buddha gave many talks on giving, on principles of giving. He said, give with respect and confidence. Give with your own hands. Give with joy in being able to give. The Sanskrit word dana means to give, and the word for generosity is chaga. It means to let go of or to relinquish, to let go of our clinging to our fears that we don't have enough, to let go of our desires, to let go of our ideas and worries, to let go of our negative expectations. This letting go, this practice of surrender, this practice of gratitude and appreciation, the function of this practice of attention and gratitude and appreciation is a practice of wisdom, practice of realization. I don't care what you've seen or realized if you can't give. My deepest wish for all of you, for me, is that this practice, Adana, opens up in the happiest way for you. What a joy to serve this present moment, giving life to life, and being able to be of benefit. What a joy. Give freely with an unattached mind, with joy, without trying to get something out of it for myself. Emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. And of course, you got to strike a balance between your own real needs and the needs of others. Right time, right place, right amount. The famous painter Van Gogh, before, I didn't know this, but before he became a painter, he was actually a minister. He was like a Christian minister. And he was so deeply moved by the poverty of his congregation. He taught in this, or he was ministered to this very poor part of the city. He gave everything away. He gave everything away, and in a very short order of time, like in a few weeks, he found himself huddled under the same overhangs as his constituents were, because he'd given it all away. He had nothing left to give, and he had no ability to carry on his ministry. So there's a story from the Buddha where one time there was a person who was so stingy that he came to me. He said, what if your hand was like this? And the man said, well, that would be an infirmity if it was frozen like that. And he said, well, what if it was frozen like that? And he said, well, that would also be an infirmity. And the Buddha said, even so the practice of generosity. Even so the practice of generosity. There's a time to hold and there's a time to release. So what do we give? Certainly money, material goods, food, clothing, taking care of people, medicine. It's said that the gift of fearlessness, the gift of protection, the gift of taking care is a noble gift. But the most meritorious of all gifts is the gift of the Dharma, the gift of the teaching, the gift which ultimately liberates, which frees all beings. And how we give is important as what is given. There's a Tibetan story about a disciple waiting for important guests to arrive. And he cleaned up his place and arranged lovely offerings in the shrine room on his altar to impress his guests, and so they'd think well of him. Head Lama's coming. Maybe the Dalai Lama, who knows. But when he finished, he started to reflect. And he realized that his motivation wasn't right. So he threw dirt from the ground on some of his offerings. It said he couldn't have made a better offering. What's your motivation when you make a gift, when you make a donation, when you practice generosity? What would your gift be if no one was looking? Because there's always somebody looking. It's an important thing to realize there is always somebody looking. Who is that one? When you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets to be honored by others. I love India. I have a great, deep love for India, and I've learned a lot traveling in India. And one of the interesting things I've seen is working with beggars. I can remember the first time I went to India, the beggars were a little bit terrifying, because if you gave money to the beggars, you could be mobbed. So I remember the first time seeing this woman, and she was begging for money. She had her dead infant in front of her, and my heart was just so moved. I gave her money, and instantly there was this enormous crowd of beggars around me, because I'd given so generously, and you just didn't have enough rupees, small rupee notes, to give them all out. And I just felt afraid. I felt overwhelmed. But then I realized a very interesting thing about the beggars in India. If I took 100 rupees, there could be 100 beggars sitting in a row. And if I took 100 rupees and gave it to one of them and said, Santa Sant, among the group, everybody would nod. Thank you very much. That's all fine. When I was traveling in Pushkar, this beautiful little oasis in the Rajasthani desert that's sacred to Brahma, I had another awakening about beggars, which was very interesting for me, because I'd go out in the morning and I'd make my rounds around town, see what was happening, and inevitably, first thing in the morning, there'd be these beggars would all be, begging and cringing, and I'd give to all of them, and you learn to keep a stock of rupee notes so you can, offer to folks, and so I'd make my round, and then later on in the morning, I'd make another round, and there wouldn't be anybody, and then one time I was standing at a stall having tea. And I look down, and this guy is looking at me, and he kind of nods. And then I realize it's Joe. It's the guy that I gave to this morning, who was whining cringe, but he wasn't working anymore. He was having tea. And so it was this lovely, it just completely changed my relationship with these guys, where I could give to them freely. It was this lovely exchange where we were meeting each other as human beings, truly meeting each other as human beings, and we could sit down and have tea afterwards together. So when you give, the Buddha said, give attentively with your own hand, respectfully, not as if you were throwing it away. Remember the old Bob Dylan song, threw the bums a dime in your time, didn't you? Give respectfully with your own hand, with the aspiration that something good is going to come out of it. For me, I try to give seeing the humanity, truly to see the humanity of the person that I have that relationship with, hand to hand, one human being to another. Similarly, when receiving, receive attentively, respectfully. So please, my friends, continue with this most important work of giving life to life, turning your attention away from the stream of thought to what's most real, to this moment, to your essential nature. Imbuing this moment with presence, inhabiting and engaging it, bringing it alive. It's a practice of gratitude. That's a practice of thank you very much, I have no complaints whatsoever. Please, as we continue on our voyage in this session, please, as I implored you last night, please let go of everything you know. Every insight and understanding that you hold dear, please let go of your plans and strategies and just sit with clarity and attention, with curiosity and interest, with diligence. What is this? What is this? Allow yourself. yourself to be drawn into it, melt into it, put yourself into the magic oven of Zazen. Trust in the practice. Above all, trust in the practice. Whatever challenges arises, whatever arises, just the breath, just the sound. Thank you very much. I have no complaints whatsoever. Talk, talk, talk. The utter and heartbreaking stupidity of words. In truth, my friends, Zazen is the only teacher. Look. Listen. What is this? What is it that's alive? What is it that sees the floor? What is it that hears these words? What is it that feels the sensations of the body? Look directly. Look directly. Life is something to be lived, not talked about. So please, my friends, please give yourself completely to this practice.